This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We start out with one of two reports looking into the environment here in Indiana and Northwest Indiana in particular. The first report deals with a major 32-page white paper that has come out from Indiana's largest environmental public policy group, the Hoosier Environmental Council, which is entitled Our Waters at Risk, Part 2, The Impact of Coal Ash on Indiana's Water Resources. To tell us about the white paper and some of the issues that it brings up, we have with us the Director of Environmental Health and Water Policy with the Hoosier Environmental Council, Dr. Indra Frank. Dr. Frank, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Chris.
Well, give us an idea about all the work that has gone into not only studying the issue of coal ash cleanup, which Indiana is still not going through with much success, I understand, but what kind of impact it has on Indiana's water resources and such brought up here in the white paper.
Well, yeah, thank you, Chris. This report, as you point out, has two main points. First, that coal ash is impacting Indiana's water resources, and second, that Indiana is lagging behind when it comes to coal ash cleanup. So the impact to our water resources we've studied by looking at our utilities' coal ash cleanup plans and by looking at the groundwater monitoring at the coal ash disposal sites. And what we're seeing is extensive groundwater contamination. Also, our coal ash disposal currently poses threats to our major rivers in Lake Michigan, because most of that disposal is currently sitting in the floodplain. Mm-hmm. And then the contrast with other states is stark. In North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Florida, Tennessee, and Georgia, coal ash is being removed from leaking disposal sites in the floodplain. And after it is removed, they're recycling it or taking it to properly lined landfills. Here in Indiana, by contrast, the state has started approving plans that will leave coal ash in the floodplain and threatening groundwater.
Refresh our memories as to what the problems that coal ash bring, first where it comes from, and all the problems that it creates when it ends up having to be buried after it comes out of the boilers at the power plants.
Absolutely. So coal ash is the material left behind after we burn coal. Now, unfortunately, coal has traces of toxic heavy metals in it. After you burn the coal, all the carbon has been burned off, and those heavy metals are in higher concentration. If the coal ash gets wet, it contaminates water. So the safest possible disposal is disposal that prevents coal ash from coming in contact with water.
How many of the coal ash sites, especially here in Indiana, have caused problems with groundwater? There obviously must be several of them, or otherwise the HEC wouldn't be looking into them.
As a matter of fact, we have 15 coal ash disposal sites that are being monitored, and 14 of those 15 have rendered the groundwater unfit for human consumption. So they have exceeded standards for drinking water. That means we have these 14 locations where the aquifer has basically become unavailable for use for drinking water. And many of these were aquifers that would otherwise have been very productive.
You mentioned at the start of our conversation here about what other states, and in particular both of the Carolinas, North and South Carolina, and Georgia and Virginia and Florida, have been able to better control the coal ash disposal issues and keep them from contaminating waters. What are these sites doing in particular, and what should Indiana be doing if we're not?
Right. So in each of these states, coal ash impoundments that are sitting in the floodplain or that are contaminating groundwater are being excavated. They're taking that coal ash out of the leaking impoundment and taking it out of the floodplain, and then either recycling it or putting it into safe disposal. And safe disposal would be a lined landfill on high ground. The recycling is interesting. Mm-hmm. If coal ash is recycled into concrete or some other pavement-like substance, that locks away the contaminants and prevents contamination of groundwater. It also helps offset the cost of disposal.
Have any of the power plants or the utilities that control the power plants, have they been trying to find other ways to reuse and, as you mentioned, recycle some of this coal ash that they've been generating?
You know, most of the utilities in Indiana have done some sort of coal ash recycling as they're producing their ash. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at now is trying to use the ash that's been sitting in a disposal site for years. And the technology has come a long way. These methods have developed over the last couple of decades, particularly in the Carolinas and Virginia, so that now they can take the coal ash that's dug out of one of these leaking impoundments, process it to a point where it's usable in cement, and that's really a great solution for coal ash.
Tell us what the Indiana Department of Environmental Management has been doing here in trying to address the coal ash disposal issue.
Well, Chris, unfortunately, we have seen our Department of Environmental Management approve some closure plans that will leave coal ash in the floodplain. And that means they will continue to put those waterways at risk. Also, when the coal ash is disposed in the floodplain, it puts the groundwater at risk, and we wind up with an aquifer that you know won't be usable in the future. So because we've seen a couple of these approvals already coming out of the state, we're concerned that there could be more approvals coming down the pike. We've documented that there are 10 sites in Indiana where coal ash is sitting in the floodplain, and there is a written plan to leave it in the floodplain, just build a cap over the top of it. And unfortunately, those caps over the top don't stop the groundwater contamination, and the cap could be eroded during a flooding event. So we're hoping that Indiana can change course and go the way of the Carolinas and Virginia and Tennessee and, you know, start getting the coal ash out of the floodplain.
If you will give us an idea from what the white paper says, and especially in the executive summary, which you can read, by the way, on the Hoosier Environmental Council's website, hecweb.org, any specific ideas or recommendations that the HEC is making, hopefully that the state will take a look at and consider?
Well, we certainly are. I mean, the first and most critical is that we take this existing coal ash that's currently contaminating groundwater and sitting in the floodplain and move it to high ground and in a lined landfill where it will no longer contaminate groundwater. And then we can reduce the amount that has to go to the landfill by processing as much coal ash as possible for use in cement or pavement. So that's definitely, you know, our top priority is getting that kind of safe disposal of coal ash. Another is that coal ash should no longer be used as a fill material. We saw in the town of Pines that coal ash used as fill can also contribute to contaminating groundwater. And then, you know, the ultimate solution is to go to cleaner forms of energy so that mm-hmm. we're not burning coal anymore.
I know that NIPSCO has plants here in Northwest Indiana, and of course, at least a couple of them, Schaefer and Michigan City, are under serious review, I guess, for the changes that they need to make, and their plans to shut plants down to be able to go to cleaner energy, at least to go to gas powered generating plants and the like. Have you had a chance to as a member of the HEC senior staff to be able to get with NIPSCO staff members and talk with them about this?
Yes, Chris, we have. In fact, NIPSCO has been very open and good about communicating with stakeholders who have an interest in coal ash. Also, NIPSCO is excavating their coal ash impoundments and taking the ash to a lined landfill. So we're very glad to see that. The one thing that's still of concern is that at Michigan City, a lot of the coal ash is not in impoundments. It's actually buried at the site from decades past. Mm-hmm. And we're concerned because that coal ash right now doesn't have a plan, and it's sitting in the floodplain of Lake Michigan.
Is there any possibility that NIPSCO may have to review that and make some changes, especially in particular with the issues in Michigan City?
Well, I don't know that it's been ruled out yet, so we're still hopeful that yeah, something can happen for the that remaining coal ash at Michigan City.
Well, it sounds like, Dr. Frank, that at least we have some cooperation from some of the stakeholders, as one of the stakeholders, we should say, with the issue of the coal ash disposal with the NIPSCO power plants. And I guess it's just a matter of getting state officials to go along with some of the ideas that are mentioned in this white paper.
We certainly hope so.
Well, thank you very much for bringing all this to our light, and we hope that if anybody is interested in checking out the details of the paper, that they can go onto hecweb.org and take a look at least the executive summary. It's there, and the full report is there as well, too, and we appreciate you spending time with us to talk about today. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you, Chris. Thank you.
Dr. Indra Frank is the Director of Environmental Health and Water Policy with the Hoosier Environmental Council. A 32-page white paper has been issued by HEC entitled Our Waters at Risk, Part 2, The Impact of Coal Ash. And Dr. Frank is the co-author, along with Senior Policy Director Tim Maloney with the Hoosier Environmental Council. Hoosier lawmakers are finding out more about the shift in Indiana from coal generated to power to the new and emerging technologies that are out there. They will bring it up, of course, in more detail during the 2021 legislative session. But they've had a discussion among a team of Indiana University researchers that have been led by the IU Public Policy Institute. And we have with us on the program one of the policy analyst that knows the subject well. Jamie Palmer is with us. And Jamie, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you.
This is an interesting study, and a lot of the topics that we've had a chance to delve into that deal, of course, with power and with new emerging technologies for more renewable energy generally come from the Hoosier Environmental Council, and I'm sure they probably, if they haven't seen this report yet, they'll be very interested in it. But if you will, Jamie, tell us a little bit about it, how it's come about, and some of the information that comes from it.
The Indiana General Assembly tasked the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission with several studies, and they chose Indiana University to do a study of economic, fiscal, and social impacts of the transition on local communities, particularly rural ones. So we put together a team that included not only the Public Policy Institute, but the Business Research Center and the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs to put that together. We did probably three main activities. One was a literature review, both national and state, to see, you know, what everybody else was doing and to find, say, you know, economic factors and things that we could use in doing our estimates. And then we did an analysis of four coal-fired power plants and what would happen if we, some of them closed them completely and a couple of them closed partially.
Mm-hmm.
So we got information from the utilities and we used that with economic models to do those estimates. And then we also talked to local stakeholders in for the Schaefer plant, which is in northern Jasper County, and for the Petersburg plant, which is down in Pike County in southern Indiana.
I understand the Michigan City power plant there on Lake Michigan itself is one of the other plants that was under the review, I guess, through this. Of course, both of those, not only Schaefer, but the Michigan City plant are owned by NIPSCO, which is our utility here in Northwest Indiana. What did you all find out about the impact of these foreclosures?
There's a variety of things. One is that it depends on the circumstances and some of the choices that the companies make. But there is a pretty significant local impact. There are several different things that includes. So one is it impacts property taxes, and that's a really hyper-local impact because right where the plant is, and it affects the local governments that serve that property, so townships, schools, libraries, includes the county. If something were in a city, it would include the city as well. Then there are the direct economic impacts, so, you know, the lost jobs. And then there are indirect impacts that we also looked at, which are things like, so each of the plants spends money to with outside firms to do some of the work they need to get done, so for maintenance and construction and legal services and all those kind of things. So those companies will be affected. That business will be gone once something is closed or part of it's closed. And then it also affects, like, local businesses. So if something near the plant is serves the employees in the plant, like restaurants or stores, they'll lose sales based on, you know, those people not being there to buy those services or goods.
Did you find, in looking through the information to put the report together, that the greater impact might be, say, for example, in Michigan City? It's one of the larger communities. Petersburg and Rockport are, of course, communities that will be affected. And sections of Jasper County, there by the Schaefer facility, will be affected as well. But are there probably more impact on, say, Michigan City because of the size of the community and the fact it depends so much on the plant, the power plant?
I think perhaps not. Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest impact is in Pike County for Petersburg, and the reason why that is because they use Indiana coal. So the other four plants use coal from other states. And then if you think about the four plants, Schaefer is the one likely to lose the most employment. So they have about 300 employees, and they're closing completely, whereas I think data we had for 2018 was Michigan City has maybe about 120. Mm-hmm. And then so do Rockport. And then the part of Petersburg that was going to close, we estimated to be about that many. So, I mean, it really depends on, like, all those individual factors, how much of an impact there is on a particular community. And I will say that if you look at the report, you should take the numbers as sort of the worst case. We were looking at sort of what is at risk. You know, it could be one of the things that you have to think about is, well, what's going to happen with the employees? And in both northern and northwestern Indiana and in southern Indiana, they have some pretty robust economies. So, you know, employees might get transferred within the company that is not known for any of the companies yet, or somebody might be able to just go get another job in the region really quickly, and so then that's, you know, that's not going to be a big impact. But other people might not be able to do that. They might need training. So we were sort of trying to show what could happen. It doesn't mean that necessarily that will happen.
Obviously, there's going to be some kind of a tax impact in the facilities closing, and I'm sure that the General Assembly was interested in that because they're going to be having to figure that into whatever revenues that the state of Indiana would get or not get, actually. Are there possibilities that maybe they'll just have to support more renewable energy and any projects that come about from those to try to make up for the loss of the revenue?
So you're right. The property tax impact is huge for the local governments that it affects. And it's hard to plan for. Utilities have some flexibility about the way their property is assessed and where. And so it makes it a little bit hard for communities to plan. Definitely one of the possibilities is to locate renewables in the same spot. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, as a state, we don't necessarily... We aren't necessarily concerned where, say, a solar farm is, but it can be, you know, a great way to replace the assessed value in a particular place. And the very nice thing is that I think that NIPSCO and IPL have both worked with those communities to try to locate some of the solar investments they're facilitating right back in the same place, so it will affect those, you know, positively, those same local governments.
Now, I understand that the information that got into the report was gathered prior to the coronavirus pandemic really striking Indiana hard. Is there likely to be any impact because of the pandemic that will have to be figured in later, that lawmakers will have to take a look at, obviously, and figure in with whatever they have with this report to try to balance things out?
Definitely there could be. Mm-hmm. It just depends on the region, and it also, I think, depends on where in the regions when they're looking at the impacts. It might make things harder have employees get alternative employment.
Right.
Probably.
There's a lot to have to figure into things here because we know the pandemic has messed up a lot of things for everybody, including for state government when it comes to the revenues that they expect to get from the coal-fired power plants, to be sure. Jamie Palmer is a policy analyst with the Indiana University Public Policy Institute, and the Public Policy Institute has been following through on what lawmakers have asked the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission to perform, and that is a report that takes a look at the changes that will come not only economically but otherwise to Indiana from the closing, partially or in complete closing, of four generating plants that use coal, Schahfer in Jasper County and the Mission City Power Plant, as well as the Petersburg and the Rockport power plants. And Jamie, thank you very much for going through the report and letting us know what we have to look forward to. And maybe when lawmakers get in session here in January, they may have to take a look at and make some decisions. We appreciate you spending time with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Beginning today, we're going to bring you a monthly feature looking at the local as well as the national economy from the members of the staff of PNC Financial Services Group. With the report today, we have economist Abby Omadumbi. And thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today, sir.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us first what you and your colleagues there with the PNC Financial Services Group feel that we expect from not only the national economy, but our local economy as well, in trying to get back to the pre-pandemic normal.
Right. So the economic recovery has been quicker than expected, but economic activity is still well below pre-pandemic levels. I expect above average real GDP growth in the fourth quarter, although the resurgence of the virus and the absence of additional stimulus are the biggest risks to the outlook.
When you take a look at the numbers, what do you and your colleagues feel are going to be some of the ways that you're hoping that we'll get a stronger recovery out of all this?
All right, so the services sector was the sector that was hit the worst during this recession. So it's also been the one that has made the strongest recovery out of all the sectors. So it will take till the end of 2021 for things to return back to the pre-pandemic level. And we also expect additional stimulus to be passed by Congress in the next few months, and that will be a much-needed boost to the economy.
I know we've gotten some great word from some of the companies that have been working very hard on trying to come up with a vaccine to deal with the coronavirus, COVID-19. And we've had word, of course, from Pfizer and now from some other pharmaceutical companies that are in the mix trying to come up with their own materials that will in turn help go out sometime soon, we trust, as the vaccine is distributed around the country. What are your thoughts as an economist with a PNC Financial Services Group about the outlook that we see in some of this good news that we're getting here lately?
Right. So the encouraging news about the vaccines did not result to big changes in our forecast. It's great news for consumers and businesses are less likely to lay off workers if they believe that the pandemic will end in 2021. Now, an efficient vaccine will make the economic recovery faster and stronger, and the news of the vaccine has moved the risks to our outlook from the downside to more balance. Again, in order for this recovery to be very strong, we need additional stimulus from Congress. Our forecast assumes that $1.5 trillion in additional stimulus will be passed by Congress in the next few months.
Mm-hmm. Now, since we have a reported change, transition coming up here and change in leadership on Capitol Hill, as mostly in the White House, what do you folks seem to feel are the implications of the recent election and what kind of impact it's going to have, first off, on the national economy and then on the local economy as well?
All right, so the most important factor driving the economic path now is the progression of the pandemic. In terms of politics, changes are going to be incremental. So we don't expect there to be any drastic regulatory or policy changes due to the fact that there will be gridlock in Congress. And this and the news of the election did not make changes, big changes to our economic forecast.
Now, so we have this new news about the coronavirus vaccines that are out there, how the latest reports on how they're doing and the test results coming back in and how feasible and how helpful they may be in helping us deal with the pandemic. What does it seem to have, if it has any impact at all, on the Federal Reserve? Are we going to see much change in what the Fed's going to be doing here and dealing with the economy in the weeks and months ahead?
We expect the Fed to stay expansionary in the next few months into 2021. We don't expect the Fed to raise interest rates till 2024. Now, if additional stimulus isn't passed, if there is another wave of the virus, so the Fed can apply targeted tools to various small businesses or, you know, various parts of the economy to boost the U.S. economy.
Now, let's take a look at the local scene, so to speak, on the economy here. And we're talking mainly about small and medium-sized businesses, of course, around Northwest Indiana. What have you and your colleagues from PNC Financial Services seem to find in talking with businesses as to, first off, how well they're doing trying to deal with the pandemic, some better than others, I'm sure, and what kind of outlook do they have looking into the months ahead?
Our economy is that the manufacturing sector has improved in the last few months. Now, that's very positive news because manufacturing sector makes huge parts of the Northwest Indiana economy and the south side of Chicago economy. Now, one of the downsides is that the economies aren't as diverse as the national economy. So it's likely that the recovery will be slower than the national recovery.
Well, Abby, thank you very much for your thoughts and the insights that you have here on how Northwest Indiana and how the national economies are doing as we're moving ahead towards the end of the calendar year, at least. And now that we have the news of more vaccines that are showing that they're going to be successful with some luck, I guess, in helping deal with the pandemic. And we'll talk with you again next month. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Abby Omadunbi is an assistant vice president, and he's also an economist with the PNC Financial Services Group. Tammy Silverman's president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, and this month's topic of discussion that's out there on the IYI website to take a look at deals with gratitude in times of difficulty. And there's a reason, of course, with Thanksgiving, I guess, coming up, is to look for gratitude. But the times of difficulty have definitely been with us long before Thanksgiving, haven't they, Tammy?
They have. But, you know, I think this year we always try to talk about how do we teach our kids to be grateful and thankful this time of year. This year, more than others, it's going to be a little bit of a challenge, particularly as we look at Thanksgiving might feel a little different. The activities around that might feel a little different, but it's still really important that we try to model and encourage our kids to be grateful.
I know you have to have these, I guess you could even call them rituals, because they sort of are. Certainly things like Christmas and the Thanksgiving dinner, and of course football games and the opportunities to go shopping, whether it's in person or online. These are all part of life we face, and we have to be sure that as adults we keep these ideas going for the youngsters, don't we?
You're absolutely right. And you know, it's so interesting that those family rituals, they can be a lot of fun. We hope they're fun for folks. And at the same time, they hold a special meaning for our kids. They give them this sense of social connectedness, to being connected to things that are bigger than themselves, and oftentimes they're predictable and they're comforting. And that can be a protective factor for kids, particularly when we're looking at high levels of anxiety and depression and stress right now.
Now, I know it's important, of course, since we're still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, to be safe, to be healthy during these times. And I know that the list that's on the IYI website in your article talks very specifically about what CDC guidelines are, and they have some definite advice for Thanksgiving and how to be able to celebrate safely. Tell us about that.
They do. And so we're just trying to make sure everyone has access and visibility into that CDC advice on celebrating Thanksgiving safely. They talk about connecting in smaller groups, right? So rather than maybe getting together in that big family gathering, considering doing it outdoors and also considering holding your Thanksgiving virtually. In fact, one of our staff members today was saying they're calling it Zoomsgiving in her house, and so they're going to do it virtually.
Well, let's take a look at some of these ideas that you have on the IYI website about how family members can still get together in a way and still celebrate the Thanksgiving as well as the rest of the holidays without taking any serious chances with one's health. I know that you talk about in particular some of the ideas of helping people out getting ready for the holiday. Tell us what some of those ideas are.
Absolutely. Preparing is sometimes half the fun, right? And so engage your kids in that. Help them think about those that are most high risk right now for the coronavirus. So perhaps you want to prepare and deliver some of those favorite family recipes to relatives or neighbors who fall into that category. Another idea is let the kids make the invitation. If you're going to do a virtual event, maybe they can develop a playlist or a schedule, whatever that might be. The more you can get them engaged, the more excited they're going to be about it. And then meal prep, obviously a lot of work goes into Thanksgiving, the Thanksgiving meal, and you can have your kids engage with that early on. And that way, you know, if the grandparents aren't traveling in this year or a beloved family member, you can do that, you know, again, over social media or by phone and talk about where did this recipe come from? Why is it special to our family?
Now, in the specifics, what about for Thanksgiving Day?
Yes, again, here we want to let the kids engage as much as possible. In fact, let them take the lead. So whether you're home or on a virtual platform, you know, they can start the Thanksgiving meal off with a song, a prayer, a joke, even a TikTok dance, as long as you put some boundaries on it, perhaps.
Yeah.
But, you know, prepare some conversation starters so that kids, particularly if you're doing it virtually, so that kids know what to anticipate and that they can think through. Sometimes kids get nervous if you put them on the spot and they don't know what's going to be happening. And then if you do, you know, if you do want to get together a few more people than might be safe inside, think about doing it outside. You know, I know Indiana weather is iffy this time of year, but the reality is a lot of our ancestors spent a lot more time outside. So if we bundle up and perhaps get around a fire pit or heater if possible, and we can make it work.
Well, I guess you could even, for that matter, if you plan it properly, you could even do the turkey out there on that fire pit, I suppose, or at least some of the things that will go together for the meal.
You bet. There are a lot of folks that do deep-fried turkeys, right? And those are outside. So, again, they do caution against right now having everybody, you know, I think part of what we think about with Thanksgiving is everybody jammed into the kitchen and helping prepare things. That's not recommended this year, quite honestly.
No.
They say, you know, if you are get together, prepare your food in your own home and then bring it together, stay distanced. Make sure you're smart and everybody's wearing their mask and washing their hands and all that stuff that we're all really aware of right now.
Now, what was the IUI recommending for after the Thanksgiving meal into the rest of the holiday season?
Sure. Well, you know, this gratitude and connectedness doesn't have to stop Thursday night of Thanksgiving, right? So bring your kids with you. Talk about volunteering in the community, and you can still do that right now at a safe distance. So donating food or outgrown clothing, have the kids sort through those. Talk about, and this helps them understand the experience and needs of others. Right now, we know that food insecurity is at a really high level. So talk about the needs of other folks and how they might help with that. And again, shop online instead of in person. Oftentimes, we sometimes as adults do that away from our kids, but they can help do that as well if they're starting to think about the holidays. And then all those connections, puzzles, neighborhood walks, board games, those fun things that we've kind of been pushed to during the pandemic really are great to connect with our kids.
And I know that you have in the listing that's on the IYI website a link to, I guess, an article that came out called Finding Gratitude Amidst a Pandemic. Tell us a little more about that. And if people see that, if they go on the IYI website and they happen to see that link, what they'll actually see.
Yes, and so this is a great, it's a real brief article that came from Youth First, which is a organization out of southern Indiana, and they talked about, again, maybe there's some good stuff here. Look at what's good. Look at slowing down and practicing gratitude. Look at some of these ways that we can teach our kids to be grateful right now, particularly for those educators and coaches and youth group leaders we know that are being so flexible and doing a lot more work. It's a quick read, but it has some great advice in there.
That's IYI.org, where you can find that article and all of the rest of the articles that we talk about and our opportunities to talk with Tammy Silverman. And Tammy, as always, thank you for being with us today.
same. Delightful to be with you, Chris.
And happy holiday to all of you folks at the IYI, if we don't talk before then.
Same to you. Thanks so much.
Tammy Silverman is President and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.